Imagine having just 17 patrolmen responsible for covering 1.5 million acres of Blackfeet Nation lands, and that's where your baby sister has disappeared.
Discretion is advised for all ages. Case material could be disturbing and extremely sensitive for listeners.
Growing up, Ashley and her sisters spent a little time in foster care before going to live with their grandparents and other siblings. Her grandmother, Loxie, says she was a good girl, didn't give her any trouble, and could count on her to help out the most among her siblings. All the kids learn how to ride and chop wood for the wood stove and muck stalls, and hung out in the nearby creek a lot of the time. Ashley was outgoing, smart, beautiful, and feisty. She was only 5'2", but she knew how to stand up for herself. She had an infectious smile, she was a top athlete in school, and did very well at the Blackfeet Community College where she studied the environment. She did a speech about buffalo, which was an endangered species due to hunting by settlers, and she won praise across the reservation. Family and friends described her as being strong spiritually, emotionally, mentally, and physically. But after her grandfather died and a breakup of her first love, Ashley began using drugs and hanging out with an older crowd, including a guy named Sam McDonald, who was in his 50s at the time of her disappearance. He spent 6 days with Ashley before she vanished. Sam claimed that the last time he saw her was on the morning of June 11, 2017, when he dropped her to a roadside pull-off so that someone named V-Dog could pick her up from there. He says they had been partying for 4 days straight, so while they waited, he leaned back in his chair and took a nap. When Sam woke up, Ashley was gone. He looked for her but didn't find her or any of her belongings. But to him, nothing seemed off. He wasn't really concerned. He knew that she was being picked up, so he figured that that's what happened. Ashley was on a short video taken by someone hanging out at a party on the res, short for reservation. The footage showed her surrounded by people, drinking beers, and just hanging out, having a good time. That same night, Ashley sent a message to her older sister, Kimberly, asking for money. Her sister responded that she couldn't because she was in Africa. Her sister was engaged and visiting her fiance in Morocco at the time. When she got back, she did try to reach out to Ashley, but the phone just rang. But she wasn't worried about it because Ashley lost her phone often. She figured she was just visiting a family friend. Weeks started to pass, and then their father had been hospitalized for liver failure in mid-June. No one had heard from Ashley yet and hadn't been able to connect with her. It was starting to feel weird because she wouldn't skip the chance to be there with her family when her dad was going through this. They knew something was off and realized that no one had seen her since the night of the party. The family filed a missing persons report with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Tribal Police. 2 whole months passed until the BIA took the case seriously and started to investigate. They just weren't doing much about it at first since she was considered an adult. She could be doing whatever she wanted. She didn't have to stay in touch. She could just be out there living her life. But Kimberly turned into the de facto investigator for her sister's case. She talked to anyone who had information, searched the lands as much as she could with the support of other family members, pet dogs, and an occasional ranger, but she was often alone. She connected with a man named Matthew Lone Bear, an enrolled member of the 3 affiliated tribes, who lost his 32-year-old sister, Olivia, on the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. Matthew also had the same complaints of the law in his area. They didn't do anything and acted as if they hoped she would just turn up on her own. A donor bought a drone off of the search group's Amazon wish list that Matthew had organized, and since then, he had taken it upon himself to learn how to use it and search tribal lands for missing persons. He made press releases to keep his sister's case as current news in the media. For 3 days in September 2017, he helped the Loring family search the lands with his drone. So now, let's get back to V-Dog. V-Dog's real name is Paul Valenzuela, also in his 50s, and he had a history of burglary and weapons convictions in his past. He split his time between the Seattle area and the Blackfeet Reservation. He was dating Ashley for a little while before her disappearance, but he was still married and had a tumultuous relationship with his wife, Tashina Running Crane, also known as T. According to the Glacier County Court, Paul filed for divorce about a month after Ashley vanished. A YouTube user by the name of T. Eastwood posted a 14-minute video claiming that she was being set up for Ashley's disappearance, claiming that Paul has her and everyone in town knows it. The video was later removed. Nightline had an interview with T, and during the interview, Paul called her from jail, where he was serving time for an illegal firearms conviction. When she told him that Nightline wanted to talk to him, he quickly hung up. People were saying T found out about the affair and that she had something to do with Ashley's disappearance, but she claimed she didn't know about the relationship until after her disappearance. She claims that she and Paul were in Seattle during the time that she disappeared. Court records do confirm he was there in early June. However, a report from a corrections officer says that on June 9th, 2 days before Ashley's disappearance, Paul told Washington correctional authorities that he planned to go back to Blackfeet Nation to get his things and that he'd be back in Seattle in July. After this Nightline interview with T, Paul wrote Nightline a letter from prison, promising he could reveal who, quote, did all this to Ashley. Trust me, I am the only one who can, end quote. At the request of the BIA, the FBI took the lead on Ashley's case in February 2018, 9 months after her disappearance. In June 2018, the family was granted permission to search a trailer that Ashley frequented during the summer, then that they heard Paul and T also hung out at. They discovered a maroon stain beneath the shag carpet that they think could have been blood. The family turned it over to the police, but it wasn't the first time that they gave a piece of potential evidence they had found. A pair of red stained boots and a tattered sweater that the family believes belonged to Ashley was also found on the northern edge of the reservation. More than 2 years since turning those items in for DNA testing, the family hasn't received any results back. So I want to take a step back and give some detail on just the nation history itself. I would like to share some of the information that I searched for just to kind of wrap my head around the big picture of where Ashley disappeared from, kind of what things are like for this nation now. So just kind of bear with me, and I hope that you find it a little bit interesting as well. FBI figures show that Native Americans disappear at twice the per capita rate of white Americans, despite comprising a far smaller population. Cartographer Anita Lucchese, a Southern Cheyenne descendant, is creating the first ever U.S. and Canada database developed solely to finding missing and murdered Indigenous women. Native women are undervalued, and that is the main reason that this is such a problem in terms of women disappearing and being murdered constantly on multiple reservations. According to a 2016 National Institute of Justice report, 84% of Native women will experience violence at some point in their lifetime. 1 in 3 will be raped, and non-Native men will commit 96% of all sexual abuse suffered by Native women. Did you catch that? I'm going to repeat it because it is insane. 84% of Native women will experience violence at some point in her lifetime, and 96% of those cases are committed by non-Native men. In some counties, the murder rate of Native women is 10 times higher than that for any other race in America, according to the Department of Justice. In Montana, Native women are just 3% of the state population, but are a total of 30% of all missing persons. That is crazy. Arrests and prosecutions are so low due to the web of involvement between state and federal agencies that have to happen when a crime occurs on Native land. The 1978 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Oliphant v. Suquamish, ruled that tribes cannot arrest or prosecute non-natives who commit crimes on Native land. Another ridiculous thing. They can arrest a Native man if he assaults a Native woman, but if a non-Native person assaults that same woman, only a federal agent has authority. Can you imagine someone assaults your mother, your daughter, your sister, your cousin, and you're waiting around for the federal government to step in, for someone to arrive to help you, you can't do anything about it at the moment. So let's get in a little bit to the nation itself and a little bit of history about when it was established. So the Blackfeet Nation was established by treaty in 1855 and sits near the upper west corner of Montana, with the Rocky Mountains to the west and touching Canada to the north. Since the murder of two Blackfeet men during the Lewis and Clark exhibition in 1906, there has been tension and struggle with the U.S. government. They've suffered massive land loss, disease, and forced starvation due to the empty promises of government rations. There is mistrust in the justice system. Tana Flory of the Blackfeet Domestic Violence Center gives some reasons as being the forced placement of Native children in boarding schools, disproportionately high rate of incarceration of Native men and women across America, and the tons of Native children in foster care. Just recently, in 2017, after 30 years of fighting, the Blackfeet Nation and U.S. Department of the Interior announced the retirement of all illegal oil and gas leases in sacred Badger II Medicine Region, which is an area of land that they want to protect from industrialization. The nation also had rights restored to its water. The Blackfeet Nation business enterprises include a hotel, a casino, heritage center, art gallery, grocery store, phone and cable companies, medical and elderly care, a community college, child development, and support. Despite all the social development, there is still a ton of crime on the reservation that hasn't had sufficient control. Evidence gets submitted and goes nowhere in the hands of the justice system. There are over 17,000 members, and it's one of the 10 largest tribes in the U.S. and the third largest reservation in Montana. It is home to 56% of the total enrolled members and is the largest Indian population in Montana. Headquarters are in Browning, Montana. In 2015, the unemployment rate was just under 40%. An American Community 5-year survey published on Montana's official website states that in 2018, 36.8% were living below the poverty line, when in 2017 it was 30.5%. So it has gone up. So now we're gonna get a little bit into maybe what could be considered kind of a failure, in a way, of the law enforcement, and just give some information about how that's set up. So the Blackfeet law enforcement started in 1878, and Frank Goings, one of the tribal police officers, says the department would need about 50 officers to patrol the area adequately, but right now there's only 17, and funding this type of growth is a big issue. The BIA is already known for being chronically underfunded by the federal government and has continuously asked for more resources. Another considerable roadblock is that they have to navigate a complex jurisdictional maze. One is the federal government, two is the state government, and three is tribal government. Due to a Supreme Court ruling and acts of Congress, most tribes can only charge their own members with a crime, so they can't arrest anybody else who commits a crime on their private land. They have to ask for outside help. If a tribal police officer arrests someone that is a non-tribal member, they have to wait for a state police officer to come, which takes additional time for things to get moving. And most tribes are barred from charging anyone, even their own registered members, with major crimes such as rape or murder. Those cases are taken over by federal agencies like the BIA and FBI. All of these complications allow ample time and space for crimes to continue to be committed by non-tribal members. You could just imagine that if people are aware of this and they're sick in the head and they need to go out there and commit a crime, hey, why not just go onto the piece of land where it's going to take forever, if it ever happens, to find out that I did something and to commit the crime? The process involved in actually putting that person into the jurisdictional system and holding them accountable, it just seems ridiculous the way that it's set up now. And like so many things, many rules were decided so long ago where we're not advancing in areas that really matter on a day-to-day basis, like social, economic, financial issues. We are not helping each other. So much doesn't make sense for us anymore. So the case today, in November 2018, the U.S. Department of Justice put out a statement saying that the nation is among 25 tribes that will be signing up for the Tribal Access Program, or TAP, or TAP. TAP allows tribes access to information in several national databases through the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Systems Network, including the National Crime Information Center and other databases. TAP enhances tribal efforts to register sex offenders under the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. Tribes have access to orders of protection enforced nationwide, protect children, keep firearms away from prohibited persons, improve the safety of public housing, and allow tribes to enter their arrests and conviction into national databases. In October 2019, $273 million in grants was awarded to improve public safety, serve victims of crime, combat violence against women, and support youth programs in American Indian and Alaska Native communities. There are two kind of quotes or sayings that I would like to read to close out. And the first one comes from Roxanne White, who is an Indigenous activist. And she says, "A sister, an auntie, a mother that was murdered or went missing. This is our life. This is what we're born into." The other statement I'd like to read is from Matthew Lone Bear of the Three Affiliated Tribes, who was the one that had helped Kimberly search for her sister with his drone. Matthew says, "I spent a lot of time looking at these missing persons cases, and there are so many times where law enforcement really doesn't investigate. They spend more time trying to make excuses why not to search than actually just getting out there and getting it done. If you look across the U.S. at all the different reservations, even off the reservation, when Native people are missing, they don't get the same resources and they don't get the same type of press coverage than when white people are missing." So my closing thoughts, I definitely think that something happened to Ashley once she got picked up from VDOG. Just based on his past history, he seems troubled. Not to say that his wife or ex-wife had anything to do with it, but maybe she knows something, maybe she doesn't. Not sure that she was involved. She could have been. So who knows? And it's just overall really sad. Like, because of the jurisdictional mess and web that needs to, or that exists, and that kind of prohibits the proper prosecution and process that needs to happen when crimes are committed against women and just Native people, there's so much room for error. There's so much room for crime to happen. And the lands are so vast that by the time you may come across someone, they could be a skeleton. There could not be that much evidence left. The DNA is gone. The weather has taken over. Animals may have taken over. They may have been exposed, but, you know, weather and animals could have carried them off. I don't know, but it's just, I think overall a disregard for Native people in so many ways for so long, and it's just terrible. It's ridiculous how things are set up, and I don't know, sometimes or a lot of the times I feel like we just can't seem to come together and act to change a lot of these laws that clearly don't work for anyone. This is troubling and it's just sad. I know it's hard. It's hard knowing that she's not there, but my mind would be going so crazy if I just didn't have a definitive answer. If this happened to one of my family members, I would be devastated. I would constantly be trying to reconcile it in my mind. I hope I didn't bore you too much with the details about the nation, but I do think it's important just for us to learn as a refresher. You know, like I said, in school, I don't feel like I have strong knowledge of Native Americans as a people. So I'm also learning too, and I hope that sharing some of that data with you just helps you also wrap your head around the cases that we are dealing with and that it's making sense. Thank you for listening to Lost in Color Podcast. You can find more on Instagram and Twitter at Lost in Color Pod. Show notes, sources, and photos are up on the website at lostincolorpod.com.
Ashley went missing at just 20 years old in June of 2017. She is just one of the over 6,000 missing Native American women or organizations that focus on this epidemic, see our website in the resources section. You'll find information about the Urban Indian Health Institute, which performed a major study of this epidemic in the Native community.